I'm Kimberly Atkins. This is On Point. Millions of people across Texas this week in crisis mode, without power in the midst of extreme winter weather foreign to most Texans.
Every source of power that the state of Texas has been compromised.
I'm wearing several layers of clothes to keep my body warm.
It's so cold in my house that my milk is frozen, and we cannot find a hotel, and we cannot get any relief.
We have been 62 hours without any power. This town is suffering. Anybody that can get out here to help, this town is suffering really bad.
It's horrible. We've been driving around during the day with the heater on in the car just to keep warm.
My husband has been sitting in the car for a day and a half with his oxygen plugged in, trying to breathe, trying to stay alive.
Dallas Mayor Eric Johnson says the city experienced disaster on top of disaster, starting with the tornado in October of 2019, then the pandemic, and now this.
We've been hit, and we've been hit hard. What we thought would be a few days of nasty weather turned into a statewide catastrophe.
Power has now largely been returned, but the new unfolding crisis is a lack of clean water, frozen pipes, and flooding. This Dallas woman returned to her apartment to find it completely flooded.
Our whole apartment! Look at the... Everything that we brought here, we don't have nothing, y'all.
It's nothing short of a total crisis. A little later this hour, we will talk about the power grid, the reasons it failed, and the lessons this catastrophe can teach us about America's energy infrastructure. But first, I want to focus on the humanitarian crisis in Texas happening right now. Joining us from Austin, Texas, is Yasmin Smith, Justice and Advocacy Director for the Austin Area Urban League. Yasmin, thank you so much for taking the time to be with us.
Glad to be here, Kim.
So first, I want to talk about what you've been through personally. Did you lose power, and how has that affected you?
Yes, I did. The days roll together at this point. I lost power at 2:30 a.m. I was still up working, actually. I lost power at 2:30 a.m. The night after, or the morning after the first freeze. I thought it would turn back on. It never did. It got below 30 degrees in my house. I had to go out to the car to stay warm, to charge my devices in order to get back to the work. I eventually had to, break down two of my own coffee tables in the house. Thank goodness. I'm very fortunate and blessed. I had a fireplace. So I broke down tables in my house for firewood, but eventually I had to be rescued by the same entities I organized to rescue others.
Oh, that's really incredible. And has your power since been returned?
I don't know. I was rescued. I'm at a second location. I'm actually about to go there today to check the place out I guess be reminded of the carnage of what my house looks like when I'm in survival mode.
Well, I appreciate all the more you taking time to be with us, and I hope everything is well there. I want to talk about the work that you have been doing, trying to help people. Can you describe what you've been seeing on the ground and who has been most urgently impacted by this catastrophe?
Well, the Urban League has done both boots on the ground service provision and high level overarching orchestrating and coordinating of resources. I'm really proud of my community at this point because we have been able to bind together in order to help people. We've seen, lines around grocery stores. We've seen people in their homes below 30, below 20 without any food or water. We've seen hospitals having to be evacuated. We've seen those under bridges and encampments, our unhoused neighbors, getting very close to death. I personally have not been boots on ground physically. So I would like to leave that up to someone to give you more detail, and I can give you those
sure.
names of those who I'm coordinating with. But we've just seen a lot of people in pain. That's what we're getting is people in pain that need help.
And tell us a little bit about the work. I mean, when there are people who are unhoused or people who are in houses that are uninhabitable, what are you doing to help them?
Well, a huge amount of nonprofits and entities and individuals have come together to help people during this time, and that help spans a plethora of initiatives. We're making sure that coordinated effort. We're making sure that people get everything from getting rescued from their homes, getting water, being put into shelters or warming stations or hotels, whatever we had at that point, and making sure they have milk and diapers and all of the basic necessities. We're really providing holistic quality of life needs, essential needs for any individual that we can get our hands on at this point.
So I know right now I can only imagine that this is an urgent rescue effort to try to save lives, frankly. How looking ahead to the extent that you can, given all the circumstances there, what do you anticipate the long-term impact of this? Do you see this as a long-term crisis that will continue to play out the way we've seen in the past, where there have been large storms or fires that impacted a community for weeks and months ahead? And what do you think you're going to need?
I am worried that it will be long-term. I'm proud to be a Texan. I'm proud to be where I'm from. I hope that we are able to stand in the midst of that and still pick ourselves up and lean on each other and support each other to get through this. I think there's also, though, and in that, we're going to need assistance. We're going to need, the community is going to need relief because we've been holding down this fort. We've been making sure that people are alive for the weight has fallen. In my perspective, the weight has fallen to do the work on the community. So we're going to need relief. We're going to need either federal or state, if he decides to, relief. So that looks like reserves, that looks like National Guard, Red Cross. I believe FEMA is here currently now, thank God.
Mm-hmm.
So more relief like that. But I also want to talk about not just the long-term negative impacts, but I believe that this is going to prove to have long-term positive impacts because now we see exactly where the system is broken. Now we see exactly what people were less and were disposable, and now we have the data and lived experience and records to ensure that this doesn't happen again in the future.
And yes, I appreciate you making that point about the resiliency and what positive has come out of this. But on the issue of accountability, what accountability would you like to see come out of this? I mean, after all, this was a catastrophic failure. It was a human failure. What would you like to see in terms of accountability?
As a representative of the Austin Area Urban League, I would like to see the mistakes or hindrances or hurdles we faced during this time for us to learn from that, for Texas to learn from that. And to change their processes and procedures in order to ensure the safety of people in the future. Yasmin Denae Smith, as the born and raised Austinite, had to break wood down in her home and has had to organize throughout all of this. The traumatized Yas wants people to lose their jobs and for things to be rectified. This is, I think that's as far as I should go because. as you can tell, I'm a little raw right now.
It is completely understandable. And I think that raw emotion is exactly what a lot of people in charge need to be hearing at this point, Yasmin. And I appreciate you giving that to us. My last question for you is, what can people do if they want to help you, people who are listening and they want to help you? What can they do?
Please, please, please. I mean, if you're in Texas, And if you're out, please go to AAUL.org. We have donations going there so that we're able to help everyone else who is in need. We're supporting the initiatives and efforts of larger organizations so everyone can be boots on ground and everybody can be taken care of. If you're able to help boots on ground and you're in the Austin area, and even if you're not, please go to austincolds.com and sign up to be a volunteer or spend your resources in the way that you can. And more than anything, please, and again, that's austincolds.com and AAUL. Last but not least, please check on your neighbors and take care of yourself.
All right. That's Yasmin Smith, Justice and Advocacy Director for the Austin Area Urban League. Yasmin, I can't express enough our gratitude for you joining us. Please stay safe and thank you for the work that you are doing.
Thank you. Thank you for reporting out.
We are discussing the crisis in Texas as millions were without power this past week. So many others are still struggling to access clean water and food and shelter. I'm Kimberly Atkins. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Kimberly Atkins. We're talking about the crisis in Texas, the power grid failure, and the implications for the rest of the country. Bill Magnus is the CEO of the Electric Reliability Council of Texas, also known as ERCOT, the agency that manages most of Texas's energy grid. He said on CNN yesterday that the rolling outages in Texas this week were implemented as a way to keep Texas's power grid from total collapse.
I think from the perspective of the grid collapsing, I think what has happened here is a response that kept the grid from collapsing, that kept us from going into a blackout condition. Now, the difficulties that this has imposed on citizens of Texas, everybody in the state, have been enormous. And certainly, we need to look at what has happened here once we get everybody back online, which is the number one priority.
Republican Texas Governor Greg Abbott appeared on Fox News on Tuesday night, placing much of the blame for the failed Texas energy grid on renewables. He's since walked that back a bit, acknowledging that all sources of power in Texas failed.
Sean, this shows how the Green New Deal would be a deadly deal for the United States of America. Texas is blessed with multiple sources of energy, such as natural gas and oil and nuclear, as well as solar and wind. But you saw from what Trace said, and that is our wind and our solar got shut down, and they were collectively more than 10% of our power grid. And that thrust Texas into a situation where it was lacking power in a statewide basis, that was power that was spread out by that ERCOT organization that you were talking about. As a result, it just shows that fossil fuel is necessary for the state of Texas as well as other states.
Joining me now from Austin to talk about what really happened is Joshua Rhodes. He's a research associate at the University of Texas at Austin. Joshua, thank you so much for joining us.
Hi, Kim. Thanks for having me.
So first, I want to start out with you, how this has impacted you. Did you lose power? How are you doing?
We did, yes. We lost power, I think similar to Yasmin, about 2 o'clock on Monday morning. And we didn't get it back for a few days. You know, the temperature in the house, luckily, you only got down into the 40s, not into the 30s like some other folks. But yeah, I also had to retreat out to my vehicle to work out there. And then eventually we were able to find someone who still had power and heat, and they took us in for a couple of days. And we have power now and we're back and, you know, warm, trying to keep it a little cool in the house to try to share the energy with everyone else. But sure. it's been tough for us all.
And what about the water situation? Did you lose water? How are your pipes?
So we are actually, and I don't know if this is what's helping, we're at the bottom of a hill. And so we still have water. We're boiling it, obviously, because the city's not able to guarantee that it's safe. But we do have water, but I have lots of friends in town who do not or have very low pressure.
And we're going to talk a little bit later in the our conversation about water specifically. But first, I want to talk about the Texas power grid, which you understand very well. This week, I've been talking to folks I know who work in energy, and a friend of mine said to me, there are three grids in the United States, East, West, and Texas. Can you explain to us why Texas is on its own grid?
Yeah, so a lot of that kind of goes back to back at the dawn of electricity, like whenever we started building electricity, you know, grids across the U.S., we never really thought we would send power that far with the technology that we had then. And you might have actually had a utility that was just a single city block or something like that. And then eventually we figured out, like, if we connect these disparate regions, that can help with reliability. It can help move power around. We can electrify more people. And then, so we started connecting connecting within cities, and we started connecting cities to each other. And it just, they kind of naturally kind of formed, kind of around, load centers. And so if you kind of look around the edge of the Texas grid, it's pretty sparsely populated. And so not much infrastructure is really kind of built out that way, particularly when we were building the grids. And then, you know, when, by the time modern regulations came around and, you know, Texas found itself with its, you know, its own grid within its own state borders, you know, realized that, you know, well, if we don't extend beyond the state borders, we don't fall under some federal jurisdiction. And so that's been, you know, some of the reason we've also kind of kept it, you know, kept it kind of close to ourselves.
Mm. So can you explain what went wrong to our listeners? And is the fact that Texas is on its own grid part of the cause for what went wrong?
Sure. Yeah. So the Texas grid is built around summer. Like that's kind of our mindset down here. Like our capacity, our electricity grid is built to deliver air conditioning to everybody at 4 p.m. on August afternoons when it's 105 degrees outside and, you know, everybody wants to be inside because it's, you know, really hot. And like, when you think of Texas, you don't think of snow and ice. like you think of deserts, right? and hot and all these kind of things. And that's our mindset that we're, you know, kind of in. And so, but the difference between, you know, why are we able to deliver so much energy then, but not able to deliver that now, is that heating is different than air conditioning. Air conditioning is driven totally by electricity, but about 40% of only about 60% of homes in Texas use electricity for heating, and 40% use natural gas. And so the difference between summer and now is in the summer, no one else is competing for natural gas. It's all mostly going to power plants to make electricity. But in this case, you know, we were demanding so much energy from the electricity grid and the gas grid for heating at homes that it just kind of overwhelmed those two systems. Like, and to kick us while we were down, the cold also had some gas wells out in West Texas freeze some of the gathering lines that gather that gas and take it to processing facilities and put to get ready to go into our pipes. They froze. We had some water intake lines from some different other types of power plants, like coal and nuclear and other either water intake lines or sensors froze. And so they weren't able to stay online. So some of those tripped offline at the same time. So at the same time, that Texas is demanding the most energy from both of its major energy grids that it's really probably ever delivered, demanded at the exact same time, our supply went down. You know, and so we lost 30% of our thermal fleet. That's, you know, that's gas, nuclear, coal. We had some issues with our wind turbines freezing up as well. But the magnitude of those wasn't near as much as what our thermal fleet did. And so at the end of the day, it's just we pushed our infrastructure beyond, you know, the design specifications that we designed it for. And this is what we ended up with.
So I want to talk a little bit more about those different types of energy that you were breaking out there. I mean, Texas is the biggest energy producing state in the nation, and you have these different types of of natural gas, you have renewables. How does the breakdown, those different types of energy, how did that happen? And I personally didn't know until now that natural gas could freeze. But explain to us how the different types of energy failed and what we learned from that.
Sure. So a quick point on that. So when gas wells produce natural gas, other things come up with it. Water comes up with it. Distillates come up with it. And really that's the part that froze and it created like a block that didn't allow like the gas to get through. So it's
got it.
I don't think it was the gas itself freezing. But yeah, so I mean, all of those source, we had a, you know, cascading failures throughout all of those sources of energy. And yeah, it just, they just were not delivered. Actually, could you repeat your question? I may have lost it there.
Well, just that, how did the different types of renewable energy, I mean, we heard Governor mm-hmm. Abbott mention the renewables,
right.
but then say correctly that that's only 10%. The fact that you have these different types, they all failed in one way or another.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yes, go ahead.
No, just go ahead and help us understand how these different types, since we've been hearing about natural versus renewables, how do you see that breaking down in this particular failure?
Yeah. So what happens on the wind turbines is, you know, you can get ice that gets on the blades, and these are really big machines that are spinning and producing energy. They're so big, they have to be. They have to be balanced really well, because if you know, one blade gets more ice on it than another, it can start to vibrate and shake, and it can actually, you know, shake itself apart, and that would be no good. And so when you get the machines get off balance, they do have to either dial down their production, either slow down, or they have to stop production in order to not break themselves. On the natural gas side of things, we have that supply disruption. We're not able to get more natural gas out of the ground. Homes and businesses, which take top priority for natural gas during these scenarios in Texas, are demanding, you know, record amounts of it from the system. And so what we had is we called a depressurization of the natural gas system. So the natural gas pressure, we weren't able to deliver natural gas to power plants at the pressure that they are required to have. And it's kind of like if a fuel pump is going out in your car and you're not able to get enough fuel from your tank, you know, to the engine, it's just the engine won't run. And that, so it's mm-hmm. a similar thing. So some gas plants either had to turn down their capacity, they weren't able to run at full strength, or they had to shut off altogether. And then some of the other thermal plants, we call them thermal because they get hot. They're burning fuels, either natural gas or coal or nuclear fission. And they require cooling water to make sure that they don't get too hot and overheat and also break. Some events we had pipes that bring that cooling water in, or sensors that make sure that those kind of operations are working froze. Mm-hmm. And so if they freeze and you can't get cooling water, or you don't have the telemetry on your plant, you have to shut it down because you don't want it to break as well. And so there's all these individual fail safes within the individual pieces of technology or the individual pieces of the grid that took right. part of it down. And then the grid writ large, supply and demand in the electricity sector have to be met instantaneously.
Yes. And Joshua, I'm going to pause you right there, because I definitely want to talk about the issue specifically of supply and demand. But I also mm-hmm. want to bring another voice into the conversation first. Joining us from Atlanta, Georgia is Emily Grubert. She's an assistant professor of civil and environmental engineering at Georgia Institute of Technology. Emily, thanks so much for joining us.
Hi, Kim. Thanks so much for having me.
So you've been listening to Joshua and I talk about this. You're looking at this from afar. What do you think is at the heart of the failure in Texas that we've seen?
It's a great question. I think Josh has been talking about this very well, just basically pointing out that the system was not designed to be exposed to these extreme conditions. And we can talk a lot, and I think we will talk a lot about whether it should have been. But fundamentally, what's going on is that we're seeing a simultaneous failure that's also leading to really, really severe emergency conditions for many people across the state.
I'm Kimberly Atkins. This is On Point. So on the point that Josh and I were just about to talk about, Emily. It's this idea of supply and demand. And look, as Americans, we are used to energy on demand. We plug something into a wall, we expect energy to come to whatever device we plug in, and we expect to have it. Is that part of the problem? We don't store energy in ways that we used to? Or is it the fact that our energy companies should be able to handle the demand, whatever it is, with its supply?
It's a really interesting question. And I think what a lot of people don't realize is that it's not necessarily that we're not storing energy the way we used to. Electricity is actually a very difficult thing to store. And so a lot of what we hear about with regard to big advancements in battery technology is precisely about that challenge. So I think a lot of people don't realize that if you turn on a light, the power system is actually responding in real time to spin up some supply to actually ensure that that is able to happen. Because it's this very challenging thing to actually store electricity, we historically have basically tried to design our system such that supply always meets demand. One of the things that we get kind of excited about in terms of a mature decarbonized system and one that does actually have a lot of new technology associated with it is the notion that we might actually move toward a situation where we are storing energy differently than we have historically.
So, Joshua, I want to ask you, I mean, this weather event that you experienced in Texas, it was an extreme one, to be sure, but climate is changing, and these sort of events are going to become more common. How can we adapt knowing that this won't be the last time something like this happens?
Yeah, I mean, I think the climate science is pretty clear that, you know, a changing climate will, you know, lead to more variability in the weather. In Texas, when we think about that kind of thing, we kind of think we hotter, drier summers. Like how do we prepare for hotter, drier summers? I think we're going to have to take a harder look at, okay, you know, a changing climate, you know, could be potentially sending us, you know, harsher, you know, winter weather. And I say potentially, and it did. Like I've never seen all 254 counties of Texas under a winter storm warning at the same time. You know, we're going to have to get better, you know, prepared for this, because, you know, having this many millions without power when it's the coldest it's really ever been, you know, it's just unacceptable.
And what about the fact that Texas's power market is deregulated? Do you think that had an impact on this crisis?
Well, I don't know. And I was thinking a lot about this yesterday, because So when the grid operator does calculations, you know, based on what do we expect for our winter loads to be, you know, so they did those calculations. They put out a report. They put out a report. All the scenarios showed us keeping the lights on. Obviously, those scenarios were wrong. Those forecasts were wrong, and we need to work on that. But I don't know that a regulated system would have predicted such an event. Like, it's the same calculations that go in resource adequacy planning. So do we have enough power plants to make it through these types of events? Do we have enough security in the system? I think the same calculations would have been made by a regulated entity. So, I mean, I think, to an example, Louisiana is part of a grid that is fully integrated and fully regulated. And they're, you know, right to the east of us. And they have also had some blackouts. And to the north of us, the Southern Power Pool is it's a wholesale market, but all the utilities are vertically regulated, and they've had issues as well. So I don't think it's just a market design issue, but I think it's a planning issue and something we need to wrap our heads around. Maybe we're not planning for, you know, this amount of demand in this kind of weather.
Emily, in about 30 seconds, we've heard President Biden push for more renewables to be carbon neutral by 2035. Is that feasible? And did we learn a lesson about that from this event?
It's a great question. I think one of the things I've been saying for a couple of years now, basically, is that as we're thinking about actually decarbonizing our system and trying to prepare for a lot of what we need to do both to mitigate climate change and to adapt to climate change in some of these very extreme situations that we may not be able to anticipate. And as Josh said, even if we do anticipate it, we may not realize how our systems are going to perform. As we think about how we're remaking our system and really investing in this new stuff, we also need to think about a lot of the other integrated social supports and ways that we're going to make sure that this is working for everybody.
All right, I'm going to pause us right there. We're discussing the crisis unfolding in Texas and what that might mean for the power infrastructure in the rest of the country. I'm Kimberly Atkins. This is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Scene. Listen and follow Last Scene wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, On Point listeners. I'm poet and author Shinyi Pai. As you celebrate Asian American Pacific Islander Heritage Month, I invite you to listen to the 10,000 Things podcast from KUOW and the NPR Network. 10,000 Things is a podcast about modern artifacts of Asian American life, ordinary objects that tell extraordinary stories and reveal something profound about the experience of being Asian in America. Find 10,000 Things from KUOW and the NPR Network, wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Kimberly Atkins. We're discussing the crisis in Texas, the power grid that failed, and what it might mean for American energy infrastructure. So in preparing for this show, we reached out to Texans in order to hear what they were enduring. We connected with one family in San Antonio, but because the parents' English was limited, we ended up speaking, with permission, with their 12-year-old son.
Hi, my name is Angel Bocanegra, and we are a family of six, two parents, mom and dad. My mother's name is Nabor. My mom is worried about everything.
Angel said he enjoyed seeing the snow, a rarity for him, but he couldn't fully enjoy it.
It was nice to have snow, but sometimes even the prettiest things can be a little harmful.
Angel, his three siblings, and his parents endured days without power, huddling together under blankets to sleep in the cold house and finding ways to adapt.
During those 3 days, we melted snow on the matches of our oven to provide water in order to drink, wash dishes by hand, and of course, flush the toilet. We also used candles to light the house in order to see where we were walking. At this time, we are so worried because my dad has not gone back to work in 2 weeks, as well as having no money to pay the bills or buy soap in order to wash our school clothes. We actually are a little scared of the pipes freezing and having no water to drink within these days. There is a neighbor that is very sick and she doesn't have any water, and so we shared our water bottles with her. We are here helping each other as a community, just like my church, Sacred Heart, has done, giving us food and supplies in order to survive. We are hoping and we are praying right now to God so that this climate would change in order to go back to normality.
That was 12-year-old Angel Bocanegra from San Antonio, Texas. And we're talking about what went wrong in Texas and the lessons we can learn in order to adapt America's energy grid going forward. We're joined by Joshua Rhodes, research associate at the University of Texas at Austin. Also, Emily Grubert, assistant professor of civil and environmental engineering at Georgia Institute of Technology. And Emily, I'm going to go to you first. what can we learn from this about the broader American power grid? Is this a sign that we need to start rebuilding our grid from scratch in order to be prepared for events like this? Can we work to adapt off of what we already have? Because, look, we've already seen failures. I was telling the producers I lived in a 20th story apartment in New York City when the 2003 blackout hit. And that was a very difficult situation, not as difficult as what Texans are feeling now. But we've known for a while that there are some problems.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think thinking about some of the major events, it's kind of funny. I moved around a lot as a kid. So I was actually in Texas during the 2011 event. I was in the Northeast during the 2003 event. And then I was around California during a lot of those blackouts as well. And just thinking about all these different types of things we see, I think to me, the biggest conclusion here is not necessarily that we need to be focusing on the power grid as an isolated infrastructure, but that we really do need to recognize how integrated these infrastructures are and how underprepared we really are to focus on making sure that people are okay through a lot of these types of situations. At the best of times, our infrastructure supports us and gives us opportunities. At the worst of times, not being prepared can actually be fairly deadly. And so thinking about not just how we remake our power grid, but actually how we remake kind of these integrated systems to make sure that people come through these events okay, I think really does need to be a major focus as we go forward.
So what does that look like, Emily? What do you mean by that?
Yeah, so I think really thinking about what we do under emergency circumstances is probably the biggest one that's coming out of these kinds of events and these kinds of lessons. Some of it is really knowing what to do when there is an emergency. How do we make sure that people can get to a place that's safe and that sort of thing? From a much broader level, though, one of the things that I would really like to see us do is think about how we're optimizing a lot of our infrastructure systems. So rather than optimizing purely around making sure the power stays on, how do we optimize around making sure that people have access to energy services and water services and those types of things? Obviously, keeping the power grid on has a lot to do with providing those energy services, but we open up a lot of other space to think about, you know, do we need to make sure that people have safer homes and more insulated buildings to stay in when it gets cold and stuff like that? Do we need to make sure that we have emergency services that are available to get people to warming services and things along those lines? This is all kind of part of the same conversation about providing energy system services. And again, the grid is a huge part of it. It's not the only part of it.
Yeah, Joshua, you're not only an expert, but you've been living through this. What do you think about what Emily is saying about how we provide services to people?
I mean, I think that's right. I mean, I think we have to take a holistic look at it. I mean, you know, some of the things we're seeing, you know, the failures in the energy grid are cascading into failures in our water infrastructure, you know, right now with having to boil it. Some people, excuse me, don't have it. I know that in my hometown of Nacogdoches in East Texas, like the power outages actually took out the water treatment plant, burned up some motors. And so they don't have power, they don't have water either. And so then, you know, on the water front and the infrastructure, we're starting to see pipes break as things thaw and you know, people's homes are getting flooded. Our homes down here were not designed to go down to, you know, into the single digits. Our design specifications here are like 25 degrees Fahrenheit, not 5 degrees Fahrenheit. And so even if you had power, your home was, your heater was just running full out, like it just, and it couldn't keep up, you know, most likely. And so it's just, we do.
Okay, we may have lost Joshua there for a minute, but I want to go back to Emily. And on that issue of water, I mean, we've learned that this isn't just about the electric and gas and energy infrastructure. It's about our water infrastructure, too, in places like Texas that where we didn't before anticipate this cold. Is this a sign that we need to start looking at our water systems from scratch as well, Emily?
Yeah. And again, I'm not sure that from scratch is something that we even can do. I think one of the really big challenges with remaking infrastructure and trying to move into situations where we have better infrastructure is that we need them to continually operate. So it's not like we can just turn everything off for a few days or a few years and remake it. We have to do this while it's all functioning. But yeah, absolutely. The water system is a very, very challenging thing to manage. And I think we're starting to see similar things with the energy system where a lot of these extreme events are making things more challenging to manage at the same time as we haven't really invested in the types of maintenance that most people, I think, would say that we would recommend. So as a civil engineer, one of the jokes in our discipline a lot of the time is, you know, if you're trying to design a margin of safety for something, particularly for a pipe, people always make fun of civil engineers for over-designing stuff. And our response a lot of the time is, well, we told you it was going to last for 30 years and you decided to run it for 100. So of course we're going to over-design it because we know you're not going to maintain it. A lot of that stuff is catching up to us now, in addition to the new and additional challenges associated with some of these extreme events and climate change more broadly.
So I want to talk a little bit more about what Texans are experiencing now, while, as we mentioned, power has largely been restored. What's happening now are these rolling blackouts. I have family in Texas, and they are letting me know that they understand that this is necessary, but it's still very difficult. Josh, explain to us why these rolling blackouts are necessary. What are they doing?
Yeah, and sorry if my connection's a bit weak. All of our infrastructure down here is kind of struggling as we're talking about. So when we can't match supply and demand, the grid operator tells different utilities around the state to reduce their demand by a certain amount. Because again, if we don't perfectly match supply and demand, the whole thing comes crashing down, and that takes weeks to turn back on, and nobody wants that. But so different utilities around the state are given an amount of load that they have to reduce by. And so those transmission and distribution utilities they're the ones who are managing that. But each of them have what they call critical circuits. So these are circuits that have hospitals and police and EMS and fire and those things that we want to keep on at all costs. Like, that's the last thing we want going down in the system. And so what they're telling us is that whenever they did that, they reduced everything down to their critical circuits, there was just no more power to go around. And so they couldn't turn anyone off to turn someone back on, which is what they said. And in the text messages and the emails and all the things, we're going to turn your power off 45 minutes to an hour. Things will be okay. But those rolling blackouts didn't roll, and they just stayed blackouts. And, but it was because they were trying to keep all these critical things on, and they just couldn't.
Yeah. So, Emily, I'm here in Washington. When we inevitably have our next infrastructure week, what is needed from the federal government in order to prevent things like this from happening again, not just in Texas, but anywhere in the country? What should the focus be? Where should the money be spent? Do we need new or different kinds of power plants? Do we need equipment weatherizing? Where do you see the focus as it ought to be by the folks in the Capitol here?
Yeah, and I think one of the big roles of government in general in thinking about infrastructure is the capacity actually to be fairly integrated in their thinking. And so I think in a lot of cases, we know we need new power plants. We need to decarbonize our electricity system and our energy system more broadly. We also, I think, really do need to focus on ensuring that we're asking the right questions about our infrastructure. It's very easy to focus on, well, you know, let's weatherize every power plant and every pipeline in the country. That may be the answer. But I think really deeply asking, what are we trying to avoid and what are we wanting the outcomes to be when we do see extreme events and when we do see system failures can really bring us to a point where we are able to think a little bit about investment in infrastructure on both the supply side and the demand side and in some of the other infrastructures that are interconnected with our energy system.
I'm Kimberly Atkins. This is On Point. Josh, what do you think? I mean, should the focus be shifted more to renewables? Should the focus be on weatherizing what we have? If you could speak to members of Congress and give them advice, what would it be?
Well, I mean, I think there's, you know, there's two different timescales that we have to work with here. I mean, one, we have to stop the bleeding. We have to get the power back on. And we have to do, you know, everything we can to make sure that, you know, if we have another storm like this next week, obviously we're not going to build any power plants between now and next week or something like that, that we're more equitable in moving that kind of thing around. Yeah, I think long-term, like, you know, climate change driven by, you know, carbon emissions, you know, is what increasing the variability of our weather, kind of getting us into this mess. And so doubling down on that technology might not help us out, you know, in the future. It could probably end up, you know, making it worse for us in the future. And so, I mean, I think, you know, weatherization of what we have now so we can get the power on, but a longer term thinking, I think it, both of these things are required as we move forward.
Emily, is part of the problem the fact that we've allowed our infrastructure to age? To, is it poor maintenance or lack of forward thinking about what might happen to it?
Yeah, I think in a lot of cases, we have seen kind of underinvestment in maintenance. One of the really big challenges that worries me quite a bit about how we're remaking our infrastructure systems is essentially recognizing that when we are simultaneously having to adapt our systems to a new reality in terms of what kinds of events we're likely to see and what kind of design constraints we're likely to need to consider as a result of climate change, at the same time, oftentimes, you know, almost a century in some cases of underinvestment is catching up with us. And that makes it look like some of the adaptations we're making are extraordinarily expensive when a lot of this really is deferred maintenance. Some of it is new. Some of it is a different condition that we actually have to respond to. But this deferred maintenance problem is very, very widespread.
And is this a uniquely American problem? Are there other countries that are doing things that we should be paying attention to and we should be taking lessons from, Emily?
It's a good question. I'm more familiar with the American system, but I think it is actually pretty widespread that people tend not to invest as much in maintenance before they really need to. So this tendency to kind of let things run to failure is not a uniquely American situation. It is one that I think we're going to have to grapple with globally, and certainly adapting our systems and our understanding to new uncertainty and new variability in response to climate change is going to be a global problem.
And I want to ask you, too, about the point that Josh brought up, and I hadn't really thought about it this way. This is sort of circular. I mean, part of the problem with climate change is caused by these natural sources of energy, which in turn, as the climate changes, are impacted by the changing climate. It is the shift to renewables, despite how politically difficult this discussion has been. Is that a long term? Should that be the long term goal, despite the setbacks we saw with the turbines in this specific situation?
Yeah, absolutely. And I do want to counter the notion that this was largely a problem caused by renewables. That's absolutely not the case. None of these fuels perform particularly well, but because of the small portion that renewables were serving and the small expectations for what they were going to serve in this situation, the idea that it was wind is not really what was going on here. The overarching point, though, that we have to mitigate climate change and adapt to climate change at the same time, and that's going to make everything harder, is exactly correct. And I think when people talk about the fact that it's kind of disappointing that we didn't start along this mitigation path much earlier, part of what people were trying to avoid is the situation where we're mitigating and adapting at the same time.
Josh, since you were most impacted by this, I want to give you the last 30 seconds. What is the biggest thing that you would like to see happen going forward as a result of this event?
I mean, it would be great if, you know, we as Texas, as society, of policymakers would, you know, recognize the challenges that are going to be thrown our way and, you know, better plan for the future. I mean, a lot of things like a lot of the winter's weatherization things after we had a freeze in 2011 were made voluntary. And it appears a lot of, you know, the companies didn't do that. So we could have been a lot better in this mess. But, you know, we are where we are. But I hope we have that conversation going forward.
Joshua Rhodes is a research associate at the University of Texas at Austin. Joshua, thank you so much and be well.
Thanks for having me.
Emily Grubert is an assistant professor of civil and environmental engineering at Georgia Institute of Technology. Emily, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me.
You can continue the conversation and get the On Point podcast on our website, onpointradio.org. And you can follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. I'm Kimberly Atkins. This is On Point.